Good morning. On today's programme, the peace activists in Israel who are grappling with a new reality and the death of the author Alice Munro. But first we go to Kenya. Internet providers in East Africa have been inundated with complaints from service users about poor connectivity across the region in the past 2 weeks. The patchy service was caused by faults in undersea cables which connect East Africa to the rest of the world through South Africa. Millions of business users and residents have been affected by complete internet blackouts and intermittent service. From Nairobi, Amy Nirieda reports.
Submarine cables account for 90% of Africa's internet needs. Those are fibre optic cables buried thousands of metres under the ocean's surface. So, when those cables are damaged, it leaves millions of users across the region vulnerable in an internet-dependent world. This incident happened off the South African coast, just north of the port city of Durban, according to the Communications Authority of Kenya. A cut to two of these cables, which carry huge volumes of cloud-computed data around the continent, is what's been cited as the reason for the recent disruption. The continent of Africa is often plagued by cable damage. This is the third major disruption since February, resulting in questions being raised about how improvements can be made in the reliability of a tool which is so essential to daily life. Experts say that the most frequent cause of damage to sub-cables is human activity. Deliberate sabotage, a sensitive subject in itself, is very rarely recorded. And the most common causes are damage caused by fishing trawlers on the continental shelf or a ship anchor drag on the seabed. However, in this instance, the culprit is in fact likely to be nature itself, as cable ships are reporting that the most likely cause of the disruption off the coast of South Africa was an undersea landslide. The continent's economies are dependent on these types of cables, and when issues arise, it leaves many countries, particularly the more remote ones, technically cut off from the rest of the world. This comes at a very bad time for East Africa, given connectivity to Europe via the Red Sea is already degraded due to cables that were severed in February that still haven't been repaired because of the geopolitical instability in the region. The EASY cable, short for Eastern Africa Submarine Cable System, is a 10,000-kilometre cable that runs the length of the continent's east coast. It's the highest capacity line serving sub-Saharan Africa, including Kenya, Mozambique, Tanzania, Malawi and Madagascar. Those points serve a network that reaches as far inland as Khartoum in Sudan or Kigali in Rwanda, among other cities. Telecoms companies have switched to other cables to try and maintain services. However, when there's a limited number of pathways, the service gets jammed and slows down. For businesses, these outages have caused a logistical nightmare, and a fortnight later, many are still reporting connection delays. Christine Mathoni, a receptionist in a medical clinic in Nairobi, says the outages have caused chaos for vulnerable patients. Trying to access the booking system, she says, which should normally take a couple of seconds, can take anywhere up to 10 minutes, or even fail to open at all, causing delays to appointments, while they also have difficulty accessing patients' records, without which treatments cannot be carried out. The cables are about the size of a garden hose and transport huge flows of data which need to be protected. As soon as a fault is reported, cable ships are deployed to locate it. Divers cannot dive at such depths, and so the work is carried out from the surface. Rowboats are used along with remotely operated vehicles, which use a grapnel and blade to catch a grip on the cables before pulling them aboard, where repairs can be carried out. It can be as simple as inserting a new segment of cable to replace the damaged part, but locating the fault can be very difficult. Adrian Hilton, senior consultant in subsea cable systems, has written reports on such events. He says inaccuracy in pinpointing where a fault has occurred can prove very expensive as outage and repair ship times are extended, and that investing in location resources and specialist staff can save tens of thousands of pounds on each mission. Africa's population of 1.2 billion is reliant on a limited number of undersea cables for the internet. While demand continues to grow, the number of support systems in place to repair faults has stagnated, meaning the continent is more susceptible to disruptions and poor network quality is inevitable for the second largest continent in the world. For World Report, this is Amy Nirieda in Nairobi.
Next to the Middle East, where peace activists have been grappling with a new reality since the attacks on October 7th by Hamas and Israel's subsequent war in Gaza, several peace activists have lost loved ones. And after pain and fear and widening division, many are trying to return to their work despite the difficulties, as Caitlin Kelly reports from Jerusalem.
Landing in Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport, the faces of hostages line the arrivals hall, some of the posters now with condolences scribbled on them. In Jerusalem, there is a quietness and level of tension unlike before. I've arrived at a place in mourning. Amidst a backdrop of grueling war, I spent my first week speaking to those working towards a peaceful future, a concept that is still distant to many. Across the spectrum, peace workers from both sides have suffered losses, with over 35,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza and over 1,000 killed in Israel on October the 7th, including the death of Vivian Silver, co-founder of Israeli organization Women Wage Peace, in Kibbutz Be'eri. Her friend, Naima Barak Wolfman, described her death as a slap in the face for the peace camp. Vivian was known for her peace work and work in Gaza. She had warned of such event, Naima says, adding this underscored the need to solve the conflict rather than manage or diminish it. She then describes how the movement became polarized, mirroring societal divisions. Recent surveys show that 71% of Palestinians across Gaza and the West Bank support Hamas's decision to launch October's offensive, while 63% of Jewish Israeli oppose an independent, demilitarized Palestinian state. Many peace activists I speak to draw inspiration from the Northern Ireland peace process. For some, it offers hope that peace can come unexpectedly. For others, it highlights the necessity of reconciliation. Aziz Abu Sera, a Palestinian peace activist, was on his way to Belfast to meet reconciliation groups when we spoke. In 1989, Aziz's brother died from internal injuries after a year-long detention for allegedly throwing stones at the IDF in the West Bank. Aziz recounts harbouring hate until 8 years after his brother's death. He is sympathetic to what children in Gaza and the West Bank must be experiencing. He said he felt like he had a duty to hate. But when Aziz studied Hebrew and moved in more diverse circles, he began to see things differently. Interaction, he says, is crucial to the survival of the peace movement. But in-person activities are nearly impossible with the tighter movement restrictions on those living in the West Bank. Organisations like the Parents Circle Families Forum, a group of bereaved families, have had to cancel many activities and move meetings online. One of their flagship programmes, a camp for Palestinian and Israeli children, is being rerouted to Cyprus this summer. Some Israeli-based organisations like Standing Together were able to jump into action, leading rallies and marches within weeks. Bringing together Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel, the number of student groups has doubled in Israel, and there is new support from students overseas. Sally Abed, one of the group's Palestinian leaders, said they aim to offer a competitive vision of peace as an alternative to the Israeli right. All the activists I speak to mention the difficulties that come with the work, including online abuse or disbelief from within their communities. Palestinian activists say they are often accused by their peers of, in their words, normalizing the occupation. Hamza Awade, a practitioner in conflict resolution and skill building, says his work is now easier and safer since he left the West Bank for Italy. But he still has to exercise caution, as he is often accused of being a spy or a traitor. Financing is also an issue. Some organisations have folded due to lack of investment, including the US-based non-profit Hands of Peace. As the organisation's Palestine manager, Hamza described how the lack of investment in peace, compared to military aid, hinders efforts. As I join members of Standing Together and Women Wage Peace at the weekly anti-government and ceasefire demonstrations, it still seems that there are some who are determined. When I ask Naima how she continues with this work, she says the only way is to look forward, as we join thousands marching through the streets of Tel Aviv. I met Mawar Zinon on one of his new peace tours around the city of Nazareth. His infectious smile when he speaks of peace is hard to reconcile with the knowledge that both his parents were killed on October the 7th. As we stroll through Jesus' hometown, he energetically tells us about his journey to peace. He speaks at length about his admiration for his hard-working father and artistic mother, Bilha and Yaakov Inon, who instilled in him the values of persistence and the importance of dreaming. Mawaz realizes now that they had prepared him for October. He believes that peace is only a few years away, and this weekend, he is off to give the Pope that same message. 7 months on, there are mixed feelings about whether we are closer or further from peace, but it's clear that in a polarized society, it will take a lot of work to sow the seeds of empathy across newly hardened divisions. One of the peace movement's veteran members is Robbie Damelin, She recounts numerous stories from her 20 years with the Parents Circle Families Forum. She has just returned from trips promoting her work on peace in Germany and the US when we meet in her home in Jaffa. She explains how some international organizations across the world are also asking her to help resolve their internal tensions arising from the current conflict. She starts to show me pictures from her travels, but stops scrolling on an image of a brunette man in his late 20s. "This is David," she says. Robbie's son David was killed by a Palestinian sniper in 2002. When soldiers arrived at her door to deliver the life-changing news, she warned them not to kill anybody in his name. Much like 2002, the events of October 7th have supercharged Robbie's determination to keep on working for peace. She remembers how it was mothers who brought her the most solace when David was killed. For Robbie, motherhood is part of the rhetoric of peacemaking. She says it's knowing that everyone has lost children and then wanting to do anything to prevent another mother from experiencing this pain again. Because, she says, all their tears are exactly the same colour. This is Caitlin Kelly for World Report from Jerusalem.
Finally, we go to Canada, where Canadians and the literary world are mourning the death of one of the country's most renowned authors. Nobel laureate Alice Munro died earlier this month. She was 92. She died at her home in Port Hope, Ontario, east of Toronto, surrounded by her family. Munro had been revered worldwide as a giant of the short story genre. But as Dan Karpenchuk reports, she had been in frail health for years, fighting dementia.
Alice Munro often spoke of retirement over the past 20 years, but that didn't happen until after her short story collection, Dear Life, written in 2012. It was her last work. Marlene Goldman, a Canadian literature professor at the University of Toronto, said of Munro's death, "I feel like this is like the disappearance of a planet from the sky." Goldman says she was so important not only to readers of her generation and subsequent generations, but to literary critics, and just as a globally celebrated writer. She won many awards, both nationally in Canada and internationally, not only for the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2013, but Britain's Man Booker Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award in the United States, and in Canada, the Governor General's Award for Literature, which she won 3 times, and the Giller Prize twice. Professor Jan Plug of Western University in London, Ontario, called her a writer's writer because she was revered by other writers, and in the short story form she was often compared to Anton Chekhov and John Cheever as a master of the contemporary short story. Munro never considered herself a novelist. She was a short story writer by choice. One editor who worked at Alfred Knopf did not want to publish Munro's only novel called Lives of Girls and Women. In a memo, the editor said there's no question the lady can write, but it's clear she is primarily a short story writer. Munro herself acknowledged that, saying that she had all these disconnected realities in her own life and saw them in other people's lives, which she adds was one of the problems why she couldn't write a novel. She never saw things hanging together too well. When awarding her the Nobel Prize, the Swedish Academy pronounced her a master of the contemporary short story, someone who could accommodate the entire epic of complexity of the novel in just a few short pages. She was born Alice Ann Laidlaw in 1931 in Wingham, Ontario, near Lake Huron. A sign at the edge of town declares Wingham as the birthplace of Alice Munro. She attended elementary and high school in Wingham, then headed off to Western University, where she wrote her first set of stories at the age of 19. In revolutionizing the art form, she would end up writing 14 short story collections. At the Wingham Library, the Alice Munro Festival of the Short Story has brought visitors to the town since 2001. After she died, the North Huron Reeve, Paul Heffer, released the following statement. "Alice is highly regarded in her hometown of Wingham and has had an immense impact on our community. Her deep roots here are woven into the fabric of North Huron. On behalf of our community, I would like to extend sincere condolences to Alice Munro's family, loved ones, and friends. Today our community is mourning together with the rest of the world." Munro often created stories set around Canada and Ontario that appealed to readers on other continents. She used inspired plot twists, cutting humor, and insights into people across age or background. She was described as having a genius for sketching a character. Her best-known fiction included The Beggar's Maid, a courtship between an insecure young woman and a rich boy who eventually becomes her husband. Corey, the story of a young woman who has an affair with a married architect, and The Moons of Jupiter, about a middle-aged writer who visits her ailing father in hospital. Monroe was part of the cultural revolution that took place during the 60s and 70s, and that was reflected in some of her characters. Some of her work was adapted for film. Monroe was married twice and had four children, one of whom died in childbirth. She left her husband in the early 1970s, saying she was not prepared to be a submissive wife. From then on, her reputation and the number of her fans began to grow, many of her stories first appearing in The New Yorker. Her first collection, Dance of the Happy Shades, was released in 1968. A year later, it won the Governor General's Award and made Monroe into a national celebrity. In an interview, she said she began writing seriously when she was 14, and before that spent much of her time making up stories in her head, adding that she's done it all her life. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.